What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
At JCPenney, fashion counts for everybody and every body. The weather is getting warmer, and it's time to swap my winter layers for fun, vibrant, and cool clothing. With so many fun things happening this spring, like Mother's Day and the Wind Down Tour, it's hard to find great-looking clothes that fit you just right. That's why I love JCPenney. JCPenney has so many stylish and comfortable options for so many different body types. I've been blown away by their selection, and everything hugs my body in all the right spots. Refresh your wardrobe this spring with style that gets you. Something to wear that fits your favorite moments of the season at prices that feel just as good. Discover brands that get you and put style and comfort first, like Worthington and Liz Claiborne for her, each in women's petite and plus sizes. Here, spring comes in all shapes, sizes, and colors. JCPenney, make everybody count.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Santa Talos's invincible bronze body is coursing with ichor and Christmas cheer.
I saw three ships.
He is here to hurl presents and goodies at your three ships as they come sailing in.
On Christmas Day, on Christmas Day, on Christmas Day in the morning, initiate Cretan defense protocol. Ho, ho, ho.
Welcome to Invention, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Invention. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick. And you know what we were doing right before we started recording? We were listening to the Smashing Pumpkins Christmas song.
We were, yeah. Which wasn't bad. I didn't dislike it.
No, I actually kind of love it. It's hilarious, though, hearing Billy Corgan gushing breathlessly about how there are toys for everyone on Christmas Day. Which is funny because, like, you can totally believe it. Like, you know, he's in... I guess I wouldn't normally think of the Smashing Pumpkins as music for children, but like the obsession, like even as an adult, I can remember what it felt like to believe that toys were incoming, like how exciting that was that you would have new objects to play pretend with.
Incoming presents, yeah. Hurtling towards your ship as they're thrown by the Bronze Age automaton Talos.
Well, you know, I would say that even as an adult, I still know what it's like sometimes to want things. Mm-hmm. But there's nothing as an adult that I feel that is equivalent to the way that I wanted toys as a child.
Oh, yeah. I've spoken on the show before about how, you know, you would want a toy so badly that you would dream about it and, like, see it in your bed with you when you woke up in the morning. And,
yeah.
It's a different realm of wants and needs when you're that age. But toys are fascinating. They've been with us since very ancient times. We have evidence of, you know, toys dating back to, you know, we have things like the wonderful horse toys of ancient Egypt. And they speak to the timeless nature of play and the use of physical objects in our play.
Yeah.
And not only in our play, also in our instruction.
Well, they also fit very much into the archaeological picture of ancient technology. Mm-hmm. The earliest physical evidence of wheels, I think, in the Western Hemisphere, definitely in the Americas, is wheeled toys, like, you know, like little statuettes of horses and stuff found in ancient Mesoamerica and South America, I believe, that have wheels for moving around on.
Yeah. And then, you know, also they have often have dual purposes as well. When I was in Hawaii most recently, I went to a few different museums that were devoted to, oceanic technology and oceanic culture. Mm-hmm. And they pointed out that model ships were essential to shipbuilders. You know, they showed in miniature what the larger product would be and helped you instruct others in how to build it. And then the reverse is you've also kind of made a wonderful toy in the process.
But also I think toys are – we shouldn't think of them as frivolous as far as inventions go, because – play is not frivolous. The play that children do shapes the – I mean, it's like the most important part of a child's education, I think, far more even than the technical subjects they learn as they grow up. I mean, you've got to be able to explore the physical world and manipulate things, and toys are an important part of that.
Yeah. In some cases, toys are actually training young bodies and young minds for the manipulation of important tools. Other times, especially in modern ages, they can be more specifically educational. Mm-hmm. Though generally when you look at the history of toys, that is kind of like the history of how we think about children, right? The idea that this is a time to educate them with toys is more or less a modern discovery, if you will. But also, there were ways to think about toys such as, think about them as products. I was reading a 1968 article by Edward A. Newmark titled British Toys, which is just all about British toys. But he points out that, these are unique as items created for sale. Most toys are aimed at an individual who will not be a repeat customer, not until some 20 years later when they perhaps buy the same toy again for their own children. Most toys have an active life of a mere, couple of years, and the test of a great toy is whether it will still be on the market a decade after its release. And so many toys pass into history only to only possibly be resurrected 20 years later on an updraft of collective nostalgia. And yet other toys have become true classics and stand the test of time. They are the sort of iconic toys that you'll see Santa Claus bringing to children in cartoons and whatnot. The kind of toys that even modern Santa Claus fictions will show Santa Claus making in his workshop.
Yeah, totally. This year in 2019, Santa will not be bringing children Pogs, mostly, and will not be bringing children Tickle Me Elmos, unless there's some strange revival. But lots of kids all over the place are probably going to be getting toy trucks and dolls and blocks. I mean, there are certain toy forms that stand the test of time.
Yeah, the sort of generic classic toys.
Yeah.
That still show up under the Christmas tree. They're still part of our lives. We've touched on some of the roles that toys play. Sometimes they educate. Sometimes it's about tool use. Other times you would just see toys emerge, sort of peeling off from technological advancements of the day. And and others are examples of specific designs intended to teach. So history is full of philosophical toys, educational toys, sports toys, war toys, adult toys, pointless toys, and more.
Right. And for that reason, we thought it might be fun to do a couple of episodes here where we just look at a series of different toys throughout history, where they came from and what made them so popular.
Right. And this will be great because these are inventions. These are things that people created and they're part of our techno history. But they're not necessarily items that benefit from an entire episode's treatment. So let's throw open Santa Talos's bag and see what kind of toys we have to discuss here today.
All right. First, it looks like we've got before us some kind of strange lament configuration type of box, except it's got a handle you can crank.
Yeah.
I don't know. What is this here?
It's a delightful little clockwork box. And if I open it, it has such sights to show me. It is, of course, the Jack in the Box, a classic toy. Again, this is one of those that you see in Santa Claus cartoons. You see Santa Claus making in old-timey Santa Claus movies. And indeed, it still shows up under the tree, sometimes with a franchise character jumping out of it instead of kind of a generic old-timey clown.
Okay, so how does the jack-in-the-box work for those youngsters who have never actually held one?
Well, one winds a crank on the side of the box to power a music box inside, generally playing something like Pop Goes the Weasel. You know, something that's dun da dun da da dun da dun da dun da dun dun, and it means the faster you crank it, the faster the song goes.
Is that still under copyright? Are we going to get in trouble?
Surely that's fair use, even if it were. But at any rate, eventually it's going to trigger the box to pop open, generally at the end of the song. And when it pops open, a coiled spring is going to launch a clown puppet into action. And generally it is the equivalent of a small hand puppet, very much in the style of Punch and Judy, the old-timey puppets. They have different names in different languages, but this would be the street puppet show to amuse children and adults, where Punch and Judy kind of just beat the crap out of each other and also encounter various authority figures. They encounter the devil.
Uh-huh.
It's often been compared, like Punch is basically
itchy and scratchy.
Yeah, itchy and scratchy. And Punch is also kind of Homer Simpson, except
yes,
a more violent Homer Simpson. Maybe he's more of a bender. I don't know. But also, in fact, I've read that Punch in a Box was a predecessor, where you would actually just have Punch himself jump out of the box once you're done cranking it. This according to Antonia Fraser's A History of Toys. But A History of Toys by Fraser also stresses that the exact origins of the Jack in the Box are unknown.
Now, I'm trying to think about categorizing this toy. Like, does it count as toy? I guess it must, but like, how does one play with it, right? Like, what is the act of playing once the thing is already popped out once and you know what's going to happen?
Yeah, it's a clockwork amusement, right?
Yeah.
It's not necessarily something that I imagine factors into a lot of children's imagination play.
Mm-hmm.
It is kind of a spectacle that is unleashed, that is surprising, and it's also kind of a trick. Another toy item that that is very similar is, of course, the canister of peanuts.
That's what I was going to bring up. Yeah, the spring snakes.
Mm-hmm.
Again, to go back to the Simpsons, the can of beer nuts. Oh, beer nuts. But then, of course, you lift the lid and the snakes pop out.
Yeah, and it's still hilarious. I just watched an episode of Stephen Colbert where he goes to New Zealand,
uh-huh,
and he gives this to, I think he gives it to Lord, the musician, telling her that it is an American tradition. And she opens it and the snake scares her. And it's delightful. Part of the joke being that there are no snakes in New Zealand.
Oh, in New Zealand. Okay. I'd been thinking Australia and I was like, what's going to happen? A funnel web spider comes out.
Now, we'll get a little into possible origins here. But basically, this has been with us for quite a while. Improved materials and technology made the toy a more widespread success in the 18th century, meaning that, you know, it wasn't just going to be the something that would please very wealthy children. It wasn't like this clockwork philosophical toy that the children would get to look at occasionally. But it does seem to emerge from this world of clockwork ingenuity.
Yes. We talked about this in our episode on the canard de girature, the pooping duck,
mm-hmm,
or the digesting duck, I guess. We put a lot of emphasis on the poop for some reason. But yeah, it was this era where there were people who were becoming increasingly good at mechanical engineering and creating these clockwork devices that had complex inner workings and thus could generate complex outward behaviors based on things that were hidden. You know, you couldn't see what was going on inside, but it was doing complex stuff.
Right.
And this was part of a history of philosophical debate about whether, in fact, living things were somehow like this. Were living things somehow machines in which all the individual parts could be identified and stuff? Or were there sort of indivisible and ineffable elements that made actual life forms in nature different from the machines built by the clockmakers?
Yeah, absolutely. And part of this whole effort, this whole movement was the emergence of music boxes, which were a tremendous success and mm-hmm. And still are very popular. Also, self-playing instruments, which we got into a little bit in our saxophone episode.
Oh, yeah.
They're a part of this whole world as well. But essentially, you can also think of the Jack in the Box as a music box that packs some punch, sometimes literally. Now, in terms of where this actual technology, like where the first Jack in the Box arises from, I've seen some, I would say, shaky sources attributing the invention to a German clockmaker of the 16th century named Klaus.
Just Klaus?
Yeah. Klaus or Claus, perhaps, which of course is leave a little suspect because of Santa Claus.
Right.
But I cannot find a firm source on this. Perhaps it's out there. Perhaps somebody can bring it to my attention. But in my research, I could not find a firm source saying, yeah, we think that a 16th century German clockmaker made the first Jack in the Box. In fact, as previously mentioned, some sources state the origin is unknown. And I've noticed several toy history books that seemingly don't explore the history of the Jack in the Box at all.
Mm-hmm.
But in looking at Gary Martin's excellent Phrase Finder website, which is wonderful, I do recommend people check it out. He has an entry on the Jack in the Box. And I also was looking at a book titled Gothic Effigy by Savid Unwin Jones. And something becomes increasingly clear. The toy seems to have been named after some turn of phrase that pre-existed it.
Hmm. So Jack in the Box, you might have, called somebody a Jack in the Box before there was a Jack in the Box toy?
Exactly. Martin points to usages of the phrase Jack in the Box and sometimes Lack in the Box from the 16th century that suggests that Jack in the Box or Lack in the Box was sort of like pig in the poke.
Hmm.
Now, if you're not familiar with that, pig in the poke means like a pig in a bag. And the idea is don't buy a pig in the bag. You know, don't buy a pig sight unseen.
Right.
Because you don't know what you'll get.
Something might be wrong with it.
Yeah.
This seems to have negative implications for the Jack in the Box restaurant.
Yeah, I don't know if they really did, like a full history. They just thought about the pleasant surprise, I guess, uh-huh. of the box. But so the idea is a Jack in the Box would mean, something unpleasant that was purchased sight unseen. Or indeed, it might mean the swindler who sells boxes that either don't contain what they're supposed to contain or contain nothing at all. And that seems to play pretty well with the basic experience of the Jack in the Box, right? The box contains a fright rather than any kind of material goods. And again, it's not even something you can play with inside. It's just a puppet that jumps out at you and startles you.
Uh-huh.
And it is, again, not unlike its toy kin, the snake in the canister of nuts.
Now, by asking that question earlier, though, about whether it's a toy, I didn't mean to undermine its role. I guess I was just asking, what actually constitutes a toy? I think it's clear that the Jack in the Boxes as a toy or whatever you want to call it are popular with children, have been for a mm-hmm. long time. And they do, even after they've been surprised once, repeat the experience. So there's something intellectually interesting going on there or developmentally interesting that they've already had it pop out once. They're not going to be surprised, but they'll still keep playing with it. They'll crank the handle mm-hmm. again and manipulate the speed of playback and stuff.
Yeah. And let's face it, if you came in to work one day and there was a Jack in the Box closed on your desk, mm-hmm. what would you do? You'd have to crank it and see what pops out, right?
Yeah.
So it does continue to have anybody that's new to the Jack in the Box will have to invoke the experience, and then they might invoke it again. Now, there is another potential origin story that sometimes makes the rounds, and that is the tale of a 13th century Norfolk Christian saint-like figure, not an actual saint, but an individual by the name of Sir John Shorn, who is said to have captured the devil in a boot. And he was also said to be blessed in the healing of gout. And, of course, this is where it gets kind of complicated, right? Because the gout, of course, is an inflammatory arthritis that might well be described as a devil in the boot mm-hmm. and has been illustrated various times through history as a monster or devil that chews on a person's foot.
Right. The idea there that gout can affect multiple parts of the body, but it often manifests in somebody's big toe.
Right. Yeah.
But you could also get it in your elbow or whatever.
Right. And then, of course, there's pseudo gout as well, which is different. But classic gout has long been with humans,
mm-hmm.
and so that's kind of complicated because on one hand this particular individual is sometimes shown as having a boot with the devil peeking out of it, and so the argument is this is kind of the basis for the box that contains what might have actually been a devil in some cases, but then becomes a clown or other figures as the as it is adapted more for children.
Mm-hmm.
But I should point out that Martin, in looking at this, thinks that the historical connective tissue between Shorn and the Jack in the Box is pretty much non-existent. So there's not a lot to actually go on there. But he does point to a firework of the 1700s known as Lack in the Box. And this was mentioned in John Babington's Pyrotechnia, which was published in 1635. And this might well be where the name comes from as well.
So would this be a firework that pops out of a box in some way?
Or at least is a – it is a – yeah, I get the idea that maybe it had some sort of box, or maybe it was just the idea that it was a surprise that it pops at all.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, you know, this could be something they got the name for this firework from the pre-existing phrase. And then both of these help to inform the naming of this strange box that has a puppet that jumps out of it. Because, again, it is a shock and it is also literally a lack in the box or a jack in the box.
Is a jack in the box supposed to be scary? Is it supposed to kind of startle the child?
I think it is supposed to startle the child. Yeah. Now, is it scary as well as startling? I think that depends on what jumps out.
Yeah.
Is it a clown, which is delightful?
Or is it now?
Yes, clowns are delightful. Clowns are for children. It's uh-huh. only adults, by and large, who think that clowns are scary. But if it's a devil, then I think you could definitely make the argument that it is intended to frighten the child or humorously frighten the adult that opens it. Now, in looking at that book, Gothic Effigy, by Jones, however, contends that the devil is still present in the Jack in the Box as, quote, horned Jack bursting from his side of confinement, unquote, is the key idea toned down to a clown in the toy. And this would their argument here is that this would have emerged from Gothic fascination with devil's ornamental boxes, such as one that he points out was in Sheridan Le Fanu's Wilder's Hand from 1864. And he ties all of this in with the ongoing influence of Gothic traditions on culture and children's costumes, toys, books, and more.
Okay, so some intentional scary elements here or associations.
Or at least, yes, yeah, that's the argument. But then again, those scary elements may have been removed to make it just merely startling to the uh-huh. child. But it is, I think, without a doubt, it is meant to be a startling toy. It is meant to be something you give to a small child and watch their face as they are shocked, surprised, and then hopefully they will laugh mm-hmm. Because, of course, it was startling, but then there is no actual threat present.
You know, my thinking has developed over the past few minutes when asking why is it that you see a child playing with the Jack in the Box repeatedly cranking it over and over
mm-hmm.
and having the thing pop out even after they've already done it, you know, once or twice. They know what's going to happen. I wonder if these are sort of like experiments with object permanence, much the same way the game of peekaboo plays a developmental role with children, like
yeah.
establishing that an object or a person can be hidden but will emerge again when the barrier to vision is removed.
That's a good point. Another thing that I'm thinking about is that the second time you do it especially, the child is probably more aware that they have control over when the startling moment occurs.
Yes.
They know it's going to occur at the end of that song, for instance. And there's probably something empowering there in realizing that they are the master of the fright they are about to receive.
Exactly. And I would say that really comes through in the way that you see children manipulate the speed of the crank mm-hmm. when they do it. Like they will often either speed way up or slow way down right towards the end of the song.
Yes.
Because the song lets you know how much more time is left before the thing emerges.
Yeah, like rushing towards the thrill and then maybe backing off a little bit.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it's interesting. It makes me kind of want to pick up a Jack in the Box. I don't think we have one in our household right now anyway. But I want to find like a good one, one with a devil inside or a Krampus. That would be nice.
Or a quartet of Cenobites.
Sure. Oh, no, surely somebody has made a lament configuration Jack in the Box. That's perfect. It's so perfect. It has to have been done already.
Right. If you haven't, if that doesn't exist, whoever's got the right Etsy shop out there, you get on it.
Yes. Yeah. I know there have been – people have adapted Rubik's Cubes into the lament configuration, but Jack in the Box is just a must-have.
All right. I think maybe we should take a quick break, and then when we come back, we can discuss the flying disc.
Had enough of those supplements that leave you feeling nothing? Symbiotica is your solution to great-tasting, all-natural supplements that actually work. Crafted with premium plant-based ingredients, their products have no seed oils, fillers, or artificial nonsense. It's just pure goodness in every pouch. Try them out and actually feel the difference today. Visit Symbiotica.com and use code IHEART for 15% off plus free shipping on your subscription order. Again, that's 15% off plus free shipping on your subscription order. Go to Symbiotica.com. That's Symbiotica.com.
Hey, have you ever used Cheapo Air?
For years, and I really like it.
With Cheapo Air, you can book online, use their app, or even over the phone. They've got great prices on over 500 airlines and millions of accommodations. They're my go-to for travel planning. And if you join their Club Miles program, you can earn points to save on the cost of your travel. Book on the app and you get double points.
Sounds like it's time I tried Cheapo Air.
Call Cheapo Air at 855-247-3279 or visit cheapoair.com/podcast.
At JCPenney, fashion counts for everybody and everybody. It's spring, and with the weather changing and so many great things coming up like Mother's Day and the Wind Down Tour, I definitely need a fresh spring wardrobe for every occasion. This spring, I'm looking for that perfect flowy spring dress for Mother's Day, as well as replacing my everyday basics. That's what I love about JCPenney. They have so many stylish and comfortable options that I always find just what I'm looking for there. Spring is a feel-good season and comes in all shapes, sizes, and colors. The fashion at JCPenney is the same way. Refresh your wardrobe this spring with styles that gets you, something to wear that fits your favorite moments of the season at prices that feel just as good. Discover brands that get you and put style and comfort first, like Worthington and Liz Claiborne for her, each in women's petite and plus sizes, and Stafford and Mutual Weave for him, style and comfort for all, even big and tall. Plus even more for the whole family like Levi's and Exertion. Here, spring comes in all shapes, sizes, and colors. JCPenney, make everybody count.
All right, we're back. What is this marvelous flying disc that that now emerges from Santa Talos' sack?
Well, of course it is, to use the semi-branded term, the Frisbee. Robert, were you a Frisbee kid when you were a kid?
I mean, we always had Frisbees.
Yeah.
You know, I never got into like Frisbee golf or anything like that, but a Frisbee was a must-have. And still to today, like I threw Frisbee or an Aerobee, maybe some variation on the Frisbee design with my son, like literally just this weekend. So
yeah, I feel like the family tossing cliche is like the father and the son throwing the baseball, right, with the baseball gloves. I don't think that happens all that much except among like dedicated people who are actually into baseball.
Oh, I'm not into baseball and I've done it.
Yeah.
Just because it's such a cliche, you feel the irresistible tug of it. And so we ended up getting the baseball glove, the softball.
Wow.
And we threw it back and forth and I'm like, "Yes, I feel like a Norman Rockwell painting. This is great." We've only done it like, you know, two or three times, but it was neat to be a part of that Norman Rockwell experience.
Well, maybe my impression is mistaken, but I generally think that you've got this cliche of people throwing the baseball, but what is actually way more common is throwing the Frisbee.
The Frisbee, in my opinion, is far more fun.
Yes.
And less likely to break a window.
Though I remember from my childhood that somehow I always ended up getting hit in the mouth with a Frisbee.
Oh, well.
But that's great that you're throwing a Frisbee instead of a baseball there, because the Frisbee is nice and lightweight in its modern plastic form.
Yeah.
So the Frisbee is a toy that has both ancient and uniquely 20th century origins. As for the ancient origins, we know that humans have been throwing circular disc-shaped objects for sport for thousands of years, at least as far back as the 8th century BCE. For instance, we know that the discus throw was one of the five sports of the ancient Greek pentathlon, which consisted of a foot race, a javelin throw, a discus throw, a long jump, and finally wrestling. And I think training for this multi-event competition held some association with military training. You can see how there would be some overlap with the skills on display there.
Mm-hmm.
But the discus competition seemed to involve athletes throwing a heavy circular disc, not in the way we generally throw a Frisbee today with a flick of the arm, but by flinging it through a whole body twisting or spinning motion, where you would spin the body around or twist the body around and then transfer the angular momentum of the spinning body into a throw when you release the disc. And so physically, the discus throw sort of turns the body into a sling, you know, like the weapon traditionally associated with shepherds, where you would generate momentum in a rock or something by spinning it around in a circle. You do this with your whole body for the discus. There are mentions of disc throwing events in Homer's Iliad. Sometimes it's used as a measure of distance. So like you could just say that something was as far away as a young man can fling a discus. That's in there, which is a great unit of measure. There also appears to be a reference to some form of discus throwing as one of the funeral games after the death of Patroclus, right? Mm. So Patroclus burns on the funeral pyre, and then they have games in his honor. And so I wanted to read this section. This is in the Samuel Butler translation, though in the translation I'm about to read from, the thing being thrown is not called a Frisbee or a discus. It's called a quoit, which can mean like a disc but can also, I think, mean a ring rather than a solid disc. But anyway, the account goes like this. Then uprose the two mighty men, Polypoides and Leontius, with Ajax, son of Telamon, and noble Epeius. They stood up one after another, and Epeius took the quoit, whirled it, and flung it from him, which set all the Achaeans laughing. After him threw Leontius of the race of Mars. Ajax, son of Telamon, threw third, and sent the quoit beyond any mark that had been made yet. But when mighty Polypoides took the quoit, he hurled it as though it had been a stockman's stick, which he sends flying among his cattle when he's driving them. So far did his throw outdistance those of the others.
Oh.
Again, with the point of comparison that it's not very helpful to me. I don't know what you do with the stockman's stick, but apparently that means you could throw it really far. And then, of course, it shows up again in the works of Homer. Like in the Odyssey, there's a section where Odysseus embarrasses some dudes, I think the Phaeacians, by throwing a huge discus farther than any of them can. So the discus throw is also depicted in a famous bronze sculpture from classical Greece, the Discobolus, which just means disc thrower, by the sculptor Myron of Eleutherae. And the original work is lost, but there are a ton of copies from the Roman period. And it's the famous pose. You've probably seen it depicted somewhere where the discus thrower is sort of leaned over with the body twisted with the arm out. And of course, most people probably know the discus throw is also part of the modern Olympic Games, and they use sort of a lens-shaped disc of about 2 kilograms or about 4.4 pounds for the men's competition and a discus of about 1 kilogram or 2.2 pounds for the women's event. So when I was thinking about the Olympics, I started thinking like, well, what is it that makes the discus special as a thing to throw? Like there are other types of throwing competitions. I mean, just competitions of people seeing how far they could throw a rock or a javelin or something go way back into history. There's the shot put event where you're just throwing a heavy ball.
Right.
What is it that makes the discus special as a thrown object? And it turns out that the discus actually does have a lot of very interesting, unique properties that are based on its shape. So to get into those for a moment, I was reading an article by the North Carolina State Professor of Mechanical and Aerospace Engineering, Larry Silverberg, talking about the physics of the Olympic discus throw event. And he mentions that a lot of the skill in the discus throw is actually controlling the release of the discus. You know, it's not all in just like how hard you can whirl your body, how strong you are. It's very tightly controlling how the disc is oriented and what happens when it leaves your hand. And I would say the same thing is actually very true of throwing a frisbee. I don't know how experienced you are with trying to like aim a frisbee super carefully or get it to sail as far as possible. But like I think a lot of the skill actually comes down to what's happening right when you release it from your fingers.
Yeah. I feel like I'm not one that is usually especially skilled at throwing things, but I feel like there's something about throwing a frisbee or a frisbee-like toy that feels very intuitive.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't played frisbee golf and tried like that level of accuracy, but I find that when I throw a frisbee to someone, I have a much better ability to actually get it to them. You know what I'm saying?
Uh-huh. Oh, well, yeah, I know exactly what you mean, this intuitive property, which is funny because at the same time, I think more so than like a javelin or a baseball or a shot put, the discus it's fickle. It's dependent on the air and wind conditions,
yes.
You know, that they can be – the discus or the frisbee can be unpredictable in how it travels in ways that these other objects are not, even though in some ways it feels very gentle and easy and intuitive to throw at someone.
Right. Like if you're just throwing the shot putt or a larger rock, you probably don't have to account for wind all that much.
Yeah. I mean, maybe a little bit, but not nearly to the extent that you would with a flat object like a discus or a frisbee. And Silverberg writes that it's really important to control the angle of release. Like you want to get it at the perfect angle to make it travel the farthest. He identifies a range between 37 and 42 degrees as optimal. And just think about like trying to fine-tune the release of a discus while you're whirling your whole body around to get it to an like a slice of the angle that small.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you have to, as we were saying, account for wind. Like if the headwind is blowing in your face, you want to throw it probably flatter, which makes sense, right? Because you don't want the headwinds blowing the – like catching under it and blowing it back toward you. You want to maximize the angle at which it gets lift but doesn't get blown back in the opposite direction. I was also reading a good 2012 article in Reuters by Sharon Begley, which summarizes some of the basic aerodynamics and some recent sports biomechanics research about the discus event. So a few key takeaways. Because of its shape, throwing a discus is different from throwing a round object like a baseball or throwing a javelin. A discus is, at its core, a wing. It's an aerofoil. As it travels, it stays aloft by generating lift, similar to how the wings of an airplane generate lift to keep the plane in the air. And like with airplane wings, the physical design of the discus matters. A flatter design with more surface area generates more lift. But once you've already picked out your discus, you know, you can't like bring a huge different shaped discus to the Olympic event, I assume. You know, once you've got the physical dimensions of the discus locked down, in order to generate maximum lift, you need to mess with a couple more main variables. One is that you want to maintain a high speed of the throw. And this is also the same way that an airplane needs horizontal speed to maintain lift via its wings, right? If an airplane slows down, it'll lose altitude, right? Because it can't generate as much lift under the wings. A discus needs to maintain horizontal speed to maintain that lift under its body. As it slows down due to drag as it travels through the air, the lift it generates will decrease and it'll fall. But then also, again, what's super important is getting just the right angle. You want the front edge of the discus raised slightly higher than its back edge to generate the most lift. And you also want to keep the disc rotating, of course, to stabilize the angle. The faster the discus is spinning, the flatter and more stable its angle will stay. And you might think about why would that be, but I bet a lot of people have done the physics experiment in like a high school physics class where you hold a spinning bicycle wheel by a little handle on its hub, and then you try to rotate the wheel against its plane of against the plane on which it's spinning. You know, try to twist your wrist or something. There's a huge amount of resistance. It's like really hard to turn it because rapidly spinning objects resist changes to the plane of their rotation. Like the angular momentum of the spinning wants to keep it flat.
It's interesting to apply that to some of like the fictional spinning weapons you see sometimes utilized in films. I'm thinking specifically one of the Three Storms in Big Trouble in Little China has these spinning gadgets that are like spinning blades. And granted, that's
the blender hands.
And granted, that's a sorcerer. So you know, we can give them a little credit. But in reality, like that would be difficult to actually use a weapon like that, right? Because it's spinning.
Oh, yeah. I imagine if it's spinning very fast, you would get some resistance to trying to move your hands around.
Right. Likewise, I think other examples are you'll see a robot using one, like Maximilian in The Black Hole. But again, high-powered robot, we can cut it some slack, I guess.
Yeah. So you want the right angle, you want high speed, you want rapid spinning to stabilize the angle. And also in this article, there's a counterintuitive finding that's conveyed by somebody named Mont Hubbard, who's a director of the Sports Biomechanics Lab at the University of California, Davis. And basically what this person says is that you can actually get the farthest possible throw by throwing into a slight headwind. That seems – you wouldn't think that. But this is because you can maximize the relative wind speed and generate more lift that way, which means more lift means it stays higher in the air longer and travels farther. Now, it's clear that the Olympic discus is a competition instrument. It's made for solo distance throwing and, of course, made for humiliating your inferiors in ancient Mesopotamia. So it's rather different from the frisbees or throwing discs that kids toss around for fun. These tend, in the 20th century, to be made of plastic. They're much lighter. They're designed to glide softly and generate tons of lift for long distance travel with minimal throwing force. You don't have to be really strong or spin your whole body around and generate the angular momentum to throw a frisbee.
Right. And then it'll generally bounce off of a window instead of going through it, that sort of thing.
Yeah. Or, you know, as often happened, you hitting me in the mouth. I mean, if you can imagine getting hit in the mouth with a 4.5-pound discus, that's not good.
Yeah.
So where did the frisbee come from, this different variation on the model? For that, we need to meet a dude named Walter Frederick Morrison, known as Fred. And I'm going to use as a few sources here. One, an obituary for Morrison from 2010 in the LA Times by Dennis McClellan. An article I found in Time by Jennifer Latson, and also a summary of his life I found by somebody named Phil Kennedy, who is a co-author with Fred Morrison of an autobiographical account of the creation of the Frisbee. But so Fred Morrison was born in the town of Richfield, Utah on January 23, 1920. At the age of 11, his father, who was an optometrist, moved his practice and thus the whole family to California. As an adult, Morrison worked as a carpenter and later as a building inspector in the LA area. But in 1937, when Fred Morrison was around the age of 17, he and his girlfriend Lucille, who would later become his wife, were at a Thanksgiving celebration at the house of Lucille's uncle. And at this party, guests just started throwing a popcorn can lid around, tossing it to each other in the backyard, which somehow sounds like either a very awesome party or a horrible party. Like, how do you end up that way? You're either having a really good time or things are going terribly and you're just desperately searching for fun.
Either way, it fits perfectly with the spirit of Thanksgiving.
Right.
But I guess I'm imagining like one of those big tins of popcorn like we still have today.
Right.
Sometimes that's different flavors of popcorn. You pull the lid off of that sucker and yeah, it's kind of a perfect Frisbee.
And apparently Fred and Lucille had so much fun, they kept throwing the popcorn lid around for the following weeks. They played with it so much that it suffered a lot of wear and tear and eventually got some kind of sharp edges and became dangerous. So they retired the popcorn can lid. They stole a cake pan from Fred's mother's kitchen and started throwing that around instead. And it looks like this started a cake pan tossing tradition. About a year later, Fred and Lucille took the cake pan to the beach in Santa Monica where they were just tossing it for fun. But apparently on this beach trip, somebody else thought that what they were doing looked like fun and came up to them and offered to pay a quarter for the cake pan so they could have it, take it, and toss it with their friends. And Fred Morrison, I think speaking to the Virginia Pilot, said, quote, "That got the wheels turning because you could buy a cake pan for 5 cents. And if people on the beach were willing to pay a quarter for it, well, there was business."
Ah, ding, ding, ding.
Flipping the cake pans. So first they just straight up bought cheap cake pans from the store, took them out to the beach to flip for a profit. So I guess there's really originally no value add here, right? Except perhaps for the insight that it might be fun to throw a cake pan. And maybe, you know, that might not have occurred to people otherwise. So maybe there is an added value there.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of like selling overpriced umbrellas on a rainy day.
Right.
For people who forgot their umbrella, it's very convenient. And yes, you get to overcharge them.
Right. Or, you know, selling bottles of water on at a hot parking lot or something. You know, people just didn't think to bring their own. Fred and his father apparently considered designing a custom metal disc for throwing, but this never came to fruition. And they kept selling cake pans at the beach until Fred Morrison went away to serve in the Army Air Corps during the during World War II in the European theater, where he flew bomber missions over Italy.
Oh, wow.
He was ultimately captured and held as a prisoner of war. And after being freed and returning home, Morrison came up with a design for a new kind of throwing disc, which he called the Whirlo Way. And I think this was named after some kind of racing horse. He was a fan of horses.
The Whirlo Way, that's what the Freeman used to overturn the rule of the Harkonnens, correct?
the wording way. So I must assume Fred Morrison consumed some spice and saw over the sands of time.
Clearly.
Yeah. But over the next few years, together with a partner named Warren Franscione, Morrison worked on a number of different designs and prototypes for discs made out of that most wonderful of 20th century consumer materials, plastic.
Ah.
So now instead of metal discs, you've got plastic discs. And because of the sudden UFO craze that gripped America beginning in 1947, they called their product the Flyin' Saucer. Apparently, Morrison was a great salesman, and he would attract crowds during Flyin' Saucer demonstrations at fairgrounds, like demonstrating how far the disc would glide with a gentle toss. Apparently, they would make jokes about, you know, how could it really travel so far? Are there hidden wires? Can you see the hidden wires? And they were able to sell some of the toys, but not enough to justify the business. And Morrison and Franscione parted ways around 1950.
Wow. You know, I'm realizing just how ingenious this product is now that I think about my own usages of the Frisbee, because there are other products and other toys that are very much in line with that, you know, those stats we gave earlier about, you know, 1 to 2 years of play life and then it's shelved and then you don't sell another one to that individual until they're a grown up.
Right.
But the Frisbee can be used by children and adults alike. And even though a Frisbee is probably pretty durable, you can break a Frisbee and, more to the point, you can land a Frisbee in a place from which you cannot retrieve it.
Yes.
And then what do you have to do? Either way, you have to buy a new Frisbee.
Right. Well, the unpredictability of Frisbees, the way they can get caught on a breeze or sail off into the neighbor's yard, that sort of makes you – yeah, it makes it more likely that you'll end up having to buy a new one.
Right. And then, of course, that's not even getting into the fact that you can print your company's logo on it and hand it out.
Oh, so good.
Yeah.
I just wonder how many like Dow Chemical Frisbees and Raytheon Frisbees there are out there. But so around 1954, Fred Morrison wanted to get back into the game. He was interested in giving the Flyin Saucer another try. So the following year, Morrison had a new model that he renamed the Pluto Platter. Again, going with the space theme, I think mm-hmm. he was like, Pluto, that's the most recently discovered planet. Let's name the toy after it.
Okay.
And you can see a patent for Morrison's model that you can actually look up from, I think, filed in 1957 and awarded in 1958. But it looks a lot like a Frisbee you would see today. It's sort of a plastic disc with a lip that curves under. But in 1957, Morrison struck gold because that was the year he sold the rights to the Pluto Platter to a toy company called Wham-O.
Wham-O.
Wham-O Inc. And Wham-O, from this point on, took care of the manufacturing and sales. I think they also helped him secure his patent. And then Morrison collected royalties on his design. But of course, we don't call these things Pluto Platters today. So what happened? Already in 1957, the toy had come to be known as a Frisbee, a name which Morrison apparently originally hated, but he warmed to over time as he collected his millions. So where did the name come from? Well, it turns out Fred and Lucille were not the only kids throwing baking pans at each other. In 1871 in Bridgeport, Connecticut, a guy named William Frisbee, spelled F-R-I-S-B-I-E, not B-E-E, opened the Frisbee Pie Company, which amazingly sold pies. And apparently it was something of a local tradition for students at various East Coast universities like Yale, which is also in Connecticut, to throw Frisbee pie tins at each other and yell Frisbee. And the Wham-O Company learned about this tradition and named their new acquisition after it. So that's where the name comes from. It's a pie company. And once the Frisbee belonged to Wham-O, it underwent some more design improvements. Crucially, in 1964, a Wham-O employee named Ed Hedrick added a series of ridges or grooves on the surface that helped the thrower grip the plastic and also increased the weight of the rim to help the Frisbee fly with greater stability. And this is actually a thing in the design of discus or Frisbee. If you distribute more of the weight to the outer edges, that helps it spin faster, have more angular momentum in spinning, which again is good for helping it maintain a stable angle. And that Time article I mentioned earlier, it includes an amazing quote from an earlier Time article, one from 1972, about Frisbee groupies of the period, a.k.a. Froupies. And I've got no words for this. It goes, quote, Dr. Stansel Johnson, a long-haired Santa Monica psychiatrist who serves as Frisbee's official historian, has an apparently sober explanation for the disc's popularity. They are, he says, quote, the perfect marriage between man's greatest tool, his hand, and his greatest dream, to fly. Well, that seems like he's kind of reaching a bit there, but then I don't know.
Waxing poetic a little bit about the Frisbee. But
it's possible we could catch ourselves saying something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
So, of course, now we know that Frisbee is not just a toy to toss with your family and your friends, but there is all this, you know, Frisbee sports of a million different kinds. There's Ultimate Frisbee. There's Frisbee Golf, which should I admit that I've played these sports and actually kind of enjoyed them?
Yeah, I mean, Frisbee Golf looks fun.
Is there Frisbee sports stigma? I sense stigma. I don't know why.
I think it's just – there are varying individuals who engage in Frisbee golf, and some are undoubtedly going to be, miscreants.
Sure.
But others are going to be, fine Frisbee enthusiasts.
Well, I confess, I've played Frisbee golf and I liked it.
All right, we're going to take another break. And when we come back, we will reach once more into the gift bag.
Enough of those supplements that leave you feeling nothing? Symbiotica is your solution to great-tasting, all-natural supplements that actually work. Crafted with premium plant-based ingredients, their products have no seed oils, fillers, or artificial nonsense. It's just pure goodness in every pouch. Try them out and actually feel the difference today. Visit Symbiotica.com and use code IHEART for 15% off plus free shipping on your subscription order. Again, that's 15% off plus free shipping on your subscription order. Go to Symbiotica.com. That's Symbiotica.com.
Hey, have you ever used Cheapo Air?
For years, and I really like it. With Cheapo Air, you can book online, use their app, or even over the phone. They've got great prices on over 500 airlines and millions of accommodations. They're my go-to for travel planning. And if you join their Club Miles program, you can earn points to save on the cost of your travel. Book on the app, and you get double points.
Sounds like it's time I tried Cheapo Air.
Call Cheapo Air at 855-247-3279. Or visit cheapoair.com/podcast.
At JCPenney, fashion counts for everybody and everybody. It's spring, and with the weather changing and so many great things coming up like Mother's Day and the wind down tour, I definitely need a fresh spring wardrobe for every occasion. This spring, I'm looking for that perfect flowy spring dress for Mother's Day, as well as replacing my everyday basics. That's what I love about JCPenney. They have so many stylish and comfortable options that I always find just what I'm looking for there. Spring is a feel-good season and comes in all shapes, sizes, and colors. The fashion at JCPenney is the same way. Refresh your wardrobe this spring with styles that gets you, something to wear that fits your favorite moments of the season at prices that feel just as good. Discover brands that get you and put style and comfort first, like Worthington and Liz Claiborne for her, each in women's petite and plus sizes, and Stafford and Mutual Weave for him, style and comfort for all, even big and tall. Plus even more for the whole family like Levi's and Exertion. Here, spring comes in all shapes, sizes, and colors. JCPenney, make everybody count.
All right, we're back. I'm going to reach into the bag once more, and whammo, here's another one. This is a hula hoop.
You mean the Whammo Toy Company?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, because they're going to factor into this invention as well. So this is a really fun toy to discuss. I actually wrote an entire How Stuff Works article about this back in the day, how hula hoops work. Mm-hmm. And I'm not going to blow through all the info in that article because in that I got to get into a lot of fun things like performance art with barbed wire hula hoops and so forth. Yeah, flaming hula hoops, the role of hula. It was a really cool one. It was one of those where it was assigned to me and I kind of groaned a little at first. And then by the end of it, I was like, oh, yeah, hula hoops are amazing.
All right.
It also gets into the physics far more than I'm not really going to get into the physics here today. But I'm going to touch on the key history. So hoop toys themselves are quite ancient, just lost in the mist of history because all you need are some dried vines and the ability to sort of, you know, loop them together and to make a loop. And as such, you know, the ancient Egyptians had hoop toys.
Now, I understand that a lot of the ancient hoop toys were used for vertical rolling, right?
Yes. Yeah. And granted, we still do that today. One of my favorite things to do with a hula hoop is to do the trick. I don't know if you know if it has a name, where you take it and you fling it out vertically, but in a way so that it will be rolling back to you.
Yeah, you put backspin on it.
Yeah,
you toss it with backspin and it rolls too. I love that too.
Yeah, it's a fabulous trick. I feel like I'm performing magic every time I do it. And I'm a little shocked that everyone around me isn't commenting on how marvelous this trick is. But of course, we all know it. We all know the trick. And then, of course, there's simply to, you know, the act of rolling a hoop around, usually using a stick to propel it, which I often think is being kind of the kind of thing you would see in a film or a TV show, like you would see Opie Taylor or Tom Sawyer doing this.
Right,
you know?
Yeah.
Kind of just an old-timey, simple toy, but something that would be fun to do. And so hoop rolling and hoop games were popular amid the ancient Greeks and the ancient Romans. The hoop is also as potent as a physical symbol representing cyclical, yonic, and cosmic concepts. The hero Ganymede is often depicted with a hoop. And in North America, the Taos Pueblo people of what is now New Mexico used hoops in sacred dances and rituals to represent, you know, the cyclical nature of life. various cultures, including the ancient British and the Cahokia people of the Mississippi River Valley. These were the mound builders who reached their peak in the 13th century and declined before the coming of Europeans. They engaged in what we often refer to as kill the hoop games. Now, this is kind of a combination of two different throwing acts. Someone will roll a hoop, and then someone will throw a spear or some other object, but often it's a spear, through the hoop. So it's, you know, you're going to hit an artificial moving target with your weapon or thrown object.
Mm-hmm. Kind of like skeet shooting.
Yeah, yeah, kind of like an early version of skeet shooting. But most agree that in playing with hoops like this, the discovery of what we think of as hula hooping was surely experimented with. So if you have children, even ancient children, in any of these cultures we've discussed, messing around with hoops, killing the afternoon with a hoop, undoubtedly somebody is going to realize that you can put it on your arm and spin it around. Mm-hmm. You can put it on your neck and spin it around. You can put it on your waist and spin it around. It's just how we were curious creatures, and in our tool use, we're going to get there. We're going to spin that hoop around our body at some point. And we also know that from military history, the concept of a hoop weapon in the form of the chakram weapon of India, which we have an older episode of Stuff to Blow Your Mind about, you know, this is something that is sometimes spun around a finger before launching, kind of like a sharp arobi toy, but used as a shock weapon on the front lines. Huh. And I believe it still remains a ritual weapon, like a holy item for the Sikhs. You'll sometimes see it presented as such. But we see like the idea of spinning a hoop-type item around your body was already known. Now, according to Charles Panatti's Extraordinary Origins of Everyday Things, there was a medieval hoop craze apparently during the 1500s, an Edwardian craze that resulted in reports of dislocated backs and heart failure. And then hula itself for hula hoop, because again, these were not called hula hoops. Hula enters the Western world in the 1700s with the knowledge of Polynesian cultures. Hoop dancing for fitness became a European craze in the late 1800s and early 1900s. And then in 1958, Whammo enters the picture, gives us the hula hoop as created by Richard Neer and author Spud Mellon, who were said to have been inspired by tales of Australian children playing with bamboo hoops. But this one, of course, the Whammo hoop is a plastic hoop, and it cost, I was reading something like $1.98, and it sold something like 25 million units in 2 months, and by the end of 58, it had made $45 million.
Wow.
So it was a colossal hit for Whammo, but it was also a craze, so it did not last as long. Like the hula hoop, sometimes a hula hoop and a human engage in a lifelong relationship.
Yeah.
You know, you really get into it. You're performing hula hoop dances, etc. Other times the hula hoop is something you play with a little bit and then it gets thrown in the garage and forgotten about.
Right.
And also, unlike the Frisbee, it's harder to destroy a hula hoop. You've really got to try to destroy a hula. I don't know. Have you ever destroyed a hula hoop, Joe?
Not destroyed one. I'm just not sure it's harder. Oh, you're much less likely to lose a hula hoop into a neighbor's yard or something.
Yeah. So I can't help but think that also attributed to the fact that sales of the hula hoop really fell off. But luckily, this was exactly the same time when Whammo moved on to the Frisbee. So they really had a 1-2 punch on inventions or reinventions that they could target towards the toy-hungry American consumer.
Right, making tens of millions off of just basic round objects.
Yeah. Recreate it, give it a fancy name, and market it. That's something we see time and time again. And in fact, when we do our next episode, which will be another reach into the toy bag, we'll see this again, where something ancient and well-known simply gets a new name and gets marketed a whole lot, and it becomes this new invention. As for the hula hoop, again, sometimes we forget about the hula hoop, but it has remained with us. You can still buy a hula hoop, wherever you are, there's a store around you where you can buy one probably. And it even, as far as holidays go, it even factors into our Christmas songs. There's the Which one is
it? Oh, that horrible Chipmunk song.
Yeah, the Chipmunk song.
Yeah.
I want a hula hoop?
Yeah, want a plane that loops the loop. Me, I want a hula hoop.
There you go. Classic toy.
I would think a chipmunk is too small to use a hula hoop.
Yeah. Now, we definitely would have to get into the physics of it because a small hoop is going to be far more energy intensive. And I'm not sure that a chipmunk, as much as I love chipmunks and squirrels, and I know our listeners do too.
Well, wait a minute. Now that I'm thinking about it, aren't the chipmunks in the chipmunks not regular chipmunk size? They are more the size of human children.
They are the size of human children,
That's a grotesque blasphemy against nature.
But still, that might make them more able to use an actual hula hoop. All right, so we're going to go ahead and call this episode here, but we will be back next week with more toys, generally like classic toys, I think, and we'll explore their history, where they came from. Do they have ancient roots? Do they have modern roots? Inevitably, do they have both? In the meantime, we'd obviously love to hear from anyone who has thoughts on these various toys. And also, are you a discus thrower? Have you experience with the sport of throwing a discus? Do you have thoughts on Joe's commentary on the physics of throwing the discus? What's your experience with those physics? We would love to hear from you.
Absolutely. Please share.
All right. If you want to listen to more episodes of Invention, head on over to InventionPod.com. That's the homepage for the show. But, of course, you can find this podcast anywhere you get podcasts. Wherever it is, make sure you've subscribed. That way you'll definitely get part two of our toy exploration. And leave us a nice rating if you have the power to do so, whatever the page is, because that helps us out in the long run. Also, be sure to check out Stuff to Blow Your Mind. That is our other podcast. And there's years and years worth of great content there as well.
Huge thanks, as always, to our excellent audio producer, Seth Nicholas Johnson. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@inventionpod.com.
Invention is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Hey, guys. Back at the playground again, huh?
Yep. You know what this playground could use? A wine country.
Heck yeah. And some waves. So we could go surfing.
Oh, yeah. Ah, love that.
A redwood forest would be cool.
I'm in.
Ah, ski slopes.
Let's do it.
Tenor girl goes shopping.
Yeah, baby.
Wait. Did we just invent California?
Discover why California is the ultimate playground at visitcalifornia.com.
This is it. We've got an Amex Platinum Pro on our hands, ladies and gentlemen. We haven't seen anyone relax like this before in the Centurion Lounge. Is he connecting to complimentary Wi-Fi? Oh, my. Look at that. He is. And you will not believe where he's going next. The Amex dedicated card member entrance for the win. Unbelievable.
When you get travel perks with Amex Platinum, you're part of the action. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/withAmex.